So my journey to studying social justice and specifically economic justice through an interfaith lens has come from a desire to push forward not only research, but also innovation, not just to create something that sits on a shelf, whether it be digital or physical, but to create solutions, innovative solutions that help people of all backgrounds, all faiths, all first generation experiences understand how to engage in economic liberation with self and with systems.
Voices with value, stories with soul, tools for transformation. This is Innovation Insights. Innovate so you do not stagnate.
Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive deep into the minds shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. I am your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. Today's guest is an extraordinary force in financial education, workplace wellness, and values-driven innovation. Raquel Wilson is a nationally recognized solutionist, author, entrepreneur, and speaker who is revolutionizing how individuals and institutions build financial resilience. Named the 2024 U.S. Small Business Administration Young Entrepreneur of the Year for Oklahoma, Raquel is the visionary founder and CEO behind ForOurLastNames.io, a tech solution transforming financial wellness through gamification and holistic design. Her reach extends globally through her Black Wealth Freedom workbook series, now used by nearly 3,000 readers in 7 countries. A former educator who began her career with Teach for America, Raquel combines her lived experience, graduate-level studies in economic justice, and entrepreneurial success to equip teams with tools to reduce financial stress, increase productivity, and foster belonging. She is the creator of powerful learning experiences, including the Pace of Productivity Keynote and the Dynamic Money Mindset and Money Moves workshop series, already a hit with institutions like Boston University and Hood Theological Seminary. Whether she is consulting with organizations on sustainable financial design, speaking on interfaith fundraising strategy, or helping individuals shift from financial trauma to traction, Raquel brings clarity, compassion, and practical wisdom. Please join me in welcoming to the Innovation Insights podcast, a trailblazer in financial wellness and social impact. Raquel, welcome to the Innovation Insights podcast. I'm so happy to have you here.
Thank you, Dr. Sanders. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yes. And please just refer to me as Yolanda.
Yeah.
We came to meet each other through a mutual acquaintance.
Yes.
Which I always like to let our guests know how that happens. That network is powerful and important. And so a former student of mine that connected us, and I'm so thrilled about this.
Absolutely. And I appreciate you, Yolanda. Our mutual contact has just been a well of inspiration to us both and doing innovation in her own right. And I think it's true that great people are connected to great people. So I'm excited to even share with your listeners the great people that are listening and what will come from this conversation.
Oh, wonderful. Yes. And I hope to get her on the podcast too at some point too. So let's start with your beginning. What inspired your transition from public health and teaching into entrepreneurship and financial wellness?
I'll tell you, I was always one of those kids that wanted to help others, whether it was being the line leader or even wanting to just help in individual relationships. I just wanted to help. But as I made my way to undergraduate school, I realized that I did not like blood enough to be a doctor or a dentist like I originally wanted to be. I shadowed my dentist, and I just recommend everyone shadow your job before you actually try to take it, because I would have went through a life of lots of bad things. But I found myself really wanting to help others, and I wanted to be in the healthcare field, but I didn't want to be a doctor. I didn't want to be a dentist, but I did learn about the field of public health. And public health consists of all things that impact your quality of life outside of just your doctor. So these are your access to street safe places to play, street lights, the signs that tell motorcyclists to wear helmets, anything relating to self or community health. And while I was interning in Washington, D.C. and working for the Federal Judicial Center, I had the opportunity to work on the judicial education team. So in short, creating education for the nation's court officials, continuing education, cultural-based education. And at the time, we were focusing on education for the Me Too movement, so judges and court officials could be aware and have education that was relevant in relation to sexual harassment in the workplace. And that summer, the light bulb really went off that what impacts our quality of life is, of course, not just our healthcare, but it's also our education. At the same time that summer, I was exposed to the Dimensions of Wellness Wheel, which is a very well-known concept in the area of public health. And some would say that educational wellness is one of the aspects or one of the dimensions that inform our well-being. So I leaned into educational wellness as my method for influencing or positively impacting one's quality of life. And as I found myself enjoying that internship and teaching judges and court officials about the Me Too movement and things of that nature, I was recruited for Teach for America the same exact summer. Instead of working with adults for education, I would be working with K through 12 in one of the many amazing cities in our country that needed educational support. And as I found myself shipped from Washington, D.C. to Ohio to where I landed with Teach for America, which was Tulsa, Oklahoma, I fell in love with this dimension of wellness, this educational wellness aspect in the classroom. And although I was assigned to teach biology because of my public health background, I was able to dive deeper into the physical wellness dimension, but I also was able to see that there was a need in my classroom for financial wellness. So ultimately, going from public health, a practitioner, to an educator, to then becoming an entrepreneur was really a cultivation of these different dimensions of wellness in this wellness wheel, specifically in relation to educational wellness and financial wellness. And now the work I do through my businesses, Raise the Bar Investments and For Our Last Names, really emphasizes the importance of holistic well-being, keeping in mind these various aspects of wellness, but specifically focusing on this educational and financial wellness portion.
We're fortunate that you made these decisions.
Thank you.
And how did your time at Teach for America and your early classroom experiences set you up to be an entrepreneur now?
All educators are entrepreneurs, even if they don't know it. And this is because teachers are the CEOs of their own classroom. Teachers are tasked with teaching a curriculum or teaching a topic, and you have so many subtopics that you must share within the class, within the school year. And that can come off pretty boring unless you are being innovative and unless you are being intentional about planning that out and unless you are being intentional about, say, creating buy-in for your students, AKA your customers, if we're aligning or paralleling those ways of thinking about the school classroom as a commerce space where you're creating solutions for those that you are called to serve, right? So I found myself in the classroom seeing problems or seeing issues that my students were having, whether it be in relation to grasping the concept that I'm teaching or even problems outside of the classroom. So as a teacher, I wanted to make sure that my students had solutions. And that led to me not only creating my own resources within the classroom, but also leaning on my fellow teaching community. So from that, it taught me in relation to entrepreneurship that impact worth having, it must be rooted in a cause worth sacrificing for. Teaching in Black Wall Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma, I found not only that public health passion and thinking about the well-being of my students and communities, but I also saw this passion and this cause to fight for awareness of the Tulsa Race Massacre and healing of my students who were descendants of the Tulsa Race Massacre. So that cause was and is still near and dear to my heart. And so I was willing to make sacrifices to be in the classroom. And even in business now, even business owners today, I'm sure every business owner can speak to the sacrifices that they make to start their business, to grow their business. Impact worth having is definitely, it has to be rooted in a cause worth sacrificing for. That's definitely one key takeaway for me in the classroom from education to entrepreneurship.
Oh, thank you for that eloquent answer. And you brought up the Tulsa Race Massacre. For our audience members that may not know what that is or what that event was and the impacts of it, would you talk a little bit more about it?
Oh, yes, I would definitely encourage all listeners to engage in your own research, whether it be the first time you've heard about it or you are familiar with the story. But every time I hear more from our Greenwood historians, I learn a new aspect of about it. So I'll aim to do it in our ancestors' justice. In 1921, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in a Black area of town named Greenwood, bombs were dropped on American soil on fellow Americans for the first time in its history. And this area, Greenwood, it was also called Black Wall Street. There were many also other Black Wall Streets in our country, Durham, North Carolina, down south as well. But here in Tulsa in 1921, there was what was called a riot at the time. And although this beautiful area that was built, this Greenwood Black Wall Street area that was built, and we had multiple airports, we had Dreamland theaters, we had a self-sustaining community where the dollar was arguably circulated over 20 times before it exited the community, this beautiful oasis of Black wealth and hope for all people was destroyed. And now, over 100 years later, we, as entrepreneurs here in Tulsa, entrepreneurs building in Greenwood, in Tulsa, in Black Wall Street, have the opportunity to not only recognize our ancestors and their sacrifices, whether familially related or not, we're all kin, but we also have the opportunity to rebuild Black Wall Street and what some would honorably call Black Tech Street. And there are organizations here such as Black Tech Street doing this work and supporting us people who have a dream, who want to live in the hope of Black Wall Street, who reclaim it not as a riot, but a massacre from which we can now build. So I encourage everyone listening to definitely pause. Let's take a moment of silence for those lives lost in the Tulsa Race Massacre. And also for them to do that research and see how it relates to their work, whether it be in the classrooms or in the entrepreneurship rooms as well.
Thank you. Thank you for summarizing that. And you mentioned the generational impacts of it and the descendants, the students that you're working with are descendants oftentimes of individuals that were part of that massacre. How has that impacted your inspiration to do the work that you do?
It fully impacts the work that I'm called to do, even through my business For Our Last Names. I remember how even that name came about. Some people understand it, some people don't, but it relates to the classroom and relates to this inspiration, so I'll share it here. When I was emerging as a teacher, I was part of the 78% of Americans living paycheck to paycheck, even though I was sold the dream that if you get a good job with benefits, you'll be fine, and I wasn't fine. So during that time, I started to learn how to invest, learn how to day trade, but because I was a teacher and working 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. some days, the only time I could find to invest in day trade would be the early morning hours, 3 a.m. to 5 p.m. sometimes. It's technically London session or like London's 9 to 5. And I saw one of my students and they saw I was tired. I had bags under my eyes that were not Chanel, not anything good. And they're like, Ms. Wilson, like, why are you doing this? Like, why are you learning a side hustle or something outside of this? At the same time, I was creating the first personal finance curriculum for the KIPP Tulsa University Prep High School system. And they're asking me, like, why are you doing this work outside of just teaching biology? Which is a great topic, by the way, but why aren't you just doing what you're assigned to? And I told them, yes, I do this for myself as a first generation wealth builder. I want to see something new come from my last name. And yes, I do this for you and the school in which I'm called to serve in this season to create something that will last and will teach financial literacy in a way that's relevant. But I also do this for our collective last names, those that aren't here yet to even see the fruit of our intentional, consistent actions. And so I told them, yeah, I do all of this for our last names. And it stuck. And as I not only created the curriculum for the classroom, as I created the Black Wealth Freedom series for over now 2,000 readers in 6+ countries, that stuck. Why do we do this? Why do we do this? What's our buy-in? What's our cause we're sacrificing for our last names? And that's one thing that my students always inspire me about, to do it not only for their last names, not only for my last name, but for our collective last names.
Impactful, innovative, and just thank you for doing that work and this education for youth too. It's so important. Would you tell us a little bit more about For Our Last Names and the Black Wealth Freedom Workbook parts of your company?
Absolutely. I'll start by sharing a little bit about For Our Last Names, which I love to speak to as a digital solution that turns financial trauma to financial traction or financial triumph. But it was birthed from my work with the Black Wealth Freedom series. And if you're joining us here via video, you'll be able to see some of my very first original copies that still have some of the tabs from being an actual workbook. And this three-part series, it really came from my work in the classroom and seeing that my students loved the personal finance education and how I taught it. Their families thought it was relevant from what they overheard from class. So I decided to make a three-part series that is easy to understand, that is easy to apply, and that is in workbook form so you can engage with the content, not just reading it, truly engaging with it, truly writing in it, truly internalizing it, and then going to do the work. So they're all, I'd say, 100 pages or less. Sometimes I like to call them airport reads because you can get on a plane, read it, and take it off and get the work done and apply it within your own life. But if I could just share the core values behind any of these projects, this first book, Holistic Money Mindset and Mental Preparation for Abundance, we can't help what we don't know, right? My parents didn't have the opportunity to learn some things from their parents about finance, which from their parents and their parents, right? Now that we know, we can do. And I think that the Holistic Money Mindset book really focuses on bringing awareness to our own financial mindsets, awareness to our own financial traumas, awareness to those phrases that you might have heard growing up that actually might be harming the way you engage with your own personal finances or your business finances. So this first book, it clears the mental pathway. It helps you deconstruct and reconstruct the ways that your money mindset may have been helpful for you and may have been harmful for you, and how we can make it an abundance mindset. This second book, Personal Finance Crash Course, What They Didn't Teach You in School, is based on what I taught my students in school. And it's chock full of the core content you need to know about personal finance, about wealth building, about sustainable wealth building. Even the first chapter, Words of Wealth, I've seen it reach ages 6 to 60 because a young adult will purchase it and their niece or nephew will read through it who's 6 years old with their parent. And it becomes actually a family activity to engage with personal finance, whether it be credit, whether it be saving, whether it be investing. This book is really going to cover all of that information in 100 pages or less to make it really achievable. And last but not least, the Money Moves Workbook, Achieving Your Wealth Goals in 12 Months or Less, is really all about bringing in that consistency. Once you brought in the awareness from the first Money Mindset book, once you've understood what action needs to be taken for your personal finance, how do we make our money moves consistently working towards our money values, consistently towards the places we desire to be in our wealth journey? And this book is really helpful because it has a monthly, a quarterly, an annually way to proactively engage with your finances, with your budget, as some people like to say, as your money flow or your money moves, as I refer to it with verbiage in this book. But it also gives you in the back chapters some really great tools to think about what might be root causes to why your money's acting funny or why your budget's off, even though you might say plan for certain things every month. Why are you having differences in what you're planning for and what you're doing? This book is really helpful in addressing consistency, addressing root causes, and even giving some resources for maybe potential next steps that might be needed beyond, say, this amazing book series. And For Our Last Names, the upcoming app is one of those resources that is a great next step to help you grow from triumph to traction.
So you're developing an app.
Yes. And honestly, we have developed it. We've received such great feedback. Thank you to our partners. Thank you to those that have beta tested, from those at Duke University, the University of California, Irvine. Over 80% positive feedback on improving financial well-being, on teaching about financial education in ways that make sense, that are relevant. Because at For Our Last Names, we really want to create a space where people can create generational wealth for their last name, whether they're a first-generation college student or first-generation college graduate, first-generation American, first-generation high earner. Hey, we're just here for the folks that didn't have these conversations over the dinner table growing up. So with this app, we've had really great success with the web solution and those that have tested it so far. Our private list of folks, join our wait list if you're first now hearing about For Our Last Names. But we will also have it available on the Apple App Store this fall. So definitely subscribe to our wait list to hear more about it.
Excellent. Excellent. Then would you also tell us about the Black Wealth Freedom Workbook?
Yes, so this three-part series, the Black Wealth Freedom series, this is the workbook series that just, yes.
So all of them together in a bundle is the whole series. Okay, I get it.
What I'll say here is that this three-part series, the Money Moves workbook, the Personal Finance Crash Course, the Holistic Money Mindset workbook, these three books bring together the Black Wealth Freedom series. These three books bring together the way, whether you are Black, whether you are brown, whether you're yellow, no matter what your color, we've had folks of all races, ages read this book, and they've walked away with something to empower them and renew their mind as they're walking in their money journey. So I definitely encourage anyone, especially if you're in a transition in life, grab yourself a set for the Black Wealth Freedom workbook series or individually one of the copies for yourself. On our website, you get a digital copy as well.
Excellent. Oh, that's great that you have it digital and physical. And it just seems like it would be a great resource for wherever you are in your lifespan.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So how do you define financial resilience?
I'll bring it back to my background as a biology teacher. And when we think about resilience, I like to think about it like working a muscle, for example. So when I think about resilience and working a muscle, I can actually train my muscle to be more and more strong or more and more resilient. So when we're talking about financial resilience, we're talking about training our mental muscles or our financial action-based muscles, aka money moves, to be stronger, to be more in alignment with our money values, to be more consistently agreeing with where we want to be. Financial resilience is being able to bounce back or being able to lean into that strength when financially traumatizing or potentially financially traumatizing situations happen. If I have financial resilience that is high, that means that I'll be able to bounce back better to life's financial woes.
Makes sense. Makes absolute sense.
In the classroom, I'd have a little stress ball that I would squeeze to show financial resilience in general. And one thing I love about the field of financial psychology and behavioral economics, which I'm trained in, is we know with the research that is out there that resilience can be built. And from that resilience that is built, we can decrease our genetic trauma, which is called epigenetics, the field of epigenetics. Anyone can look into it and learn a lot more about it. It impacts us in great ways. But just because our parents might have had trauma or our grandparents might have had trauma, and that can impact how our genes are expressed, when we actually build our resilience, when we do resilience activities, whether it be meditations, whether it be the visualizations, multiple features that we even have in the app in relation to money mindset, we can turn off those expressions of that trauma in our DNA. So I really think that anyone that is feeling like they're at a roadblock within their financial resilience or even overall life resilience, definitely look into the science of epigenetics and different resilience building activities, because the way you feel currently is not the way you have to feel next week or next month or next year. We can change our lives. We can be in charge of our destinies, and resilience building activities can help there.
So positive, which is what we need. Just thank you. Thank you. Oh, so you've given a keynote entitled The Pace of Productivity. You talked a little bit to us about that keynote address, where it was given, and what were some of the key takeaways from the keynote?
Absolutely. The leading keynote right now is The Pace of Productivity, and our leading workshops are called our Money Mindset and our Money Moves workshops. But both are really great for corporate audiences, higher education audiences, nonprofit organizations, anyone that wants to make sure their people, their best asset, are financially well or have different, their well-being, their people are well, or that the dimensions of well-being or the dimensions of wellness for their people are well. So with The Pace of Productivity, it's a framework that I've developed that really emphasizes this truth that hustle culture is not our inheritance. Health is. And if you find, for example, if you're an employer and you find that your employees are disgruntled, you need the pace of productivity to support your employees in finding the right pace to achieve your collective purpose. In this, I outline a quadrant of four different paces that we engage in. And of course, there's one in particular, the pace of grace or the pace of productivity, that can really optimize the way we adjust and the way we more so approach our tasks as we're assigned, and also addressing our task or approaching our task while managing our energy. Because we know that not every day we're going to have the same energy. So how do we still reach our goal while acknowledging we're human and on different days, our paces need to be different. How do I adjust each day? So in the pace of productivity, I provide strategic approaches, ways to address systems, and ways to even increase awareness and personal capacity to have more positive output instead of more burnout, as we're starting to see in social media. There's a whole trend about talking about burnout, talking about quiet quitting. Don't be that employer. Don't be that organization. Get the pace of productivity for your people. Now, for those that are specifically focusing on missions in relation to financial wellness, or you want to bring in financial wellness to your organization, the Money Mindset and Money Moves workshops are perfect for you. We just wrapped up the series with Boston University, even with some seminaries, and also with some high school-based nonprofits. And this really is geared towards individuals or teams or organizations who want to challenge their money beliefs. What many people don't know, I'll lean in and give y'all a secret. What many people don't know is how we view our personal finances impacts how we show up in the workplace, especially for entrepreneurs or C-suite managerial leaders. How you manage your own money, or your perspectives more so of money, of financial decisions, that impacts your financial decisions in the workplace. That impacts your decisions of how you even budget your time in the workplace. And one thing that a lot of employers don't know, or organizational leaders don't know, is that 1 in 3 employees gets distracted by their personal finance at work. So not only does it impact the leaders who are making those decisions financially, but it also impacts the employee who is now wasting your time that you are paying them for because they're worried about something with personal finances. So the Money Mindset Workshop is the number one workshop in that duo, where we talk about our different money scripts, as we like to call them in the financial psychology world. We talk about these different money scripts and different money triggers and phrases we might have heard growing up. We ain't got McDonald's money, or even impacts in the workplace, like getting laid off randomly, as we saw with many people in late 2024 and even early 2025. These are financial traumas that have been ingrained in us. So in the Money Mindset Workshop, we really break down how these money mindsets have been built, how we can deconstruct them, how we can reconstruct them to be positive for ourselves personally and professionally. And the secondary workshop, which is paired with that, the Money Moves, that's when we're talking about those financial decisions, aka the Money Moves, connecting the first workshop about financial trauma and replacing it in the second workshop with financial truths that show how we can engage in consistent ways that build the reality we want, whether it be saving, investing, debt pay down. We talk about all of those things. We hit it hard in these workshops. So whether it be the pace of productivity keynote to really give that corporate refreshing that is needed and how to turn hustle culture in the workplace into a healthy culture, or whether it be this duo two-part workshop of Money Mindset and Money Moves to really give that focused support on financial well-being instead of overall corporate or professional well-being. Both of these have been really successful and really helpful to listeners and attendees.
And it sounds like they both have some actual actions that people can take away. It's not just theoretical. And I love theory. I am a theorist in my research life, but being able to have some tangible takeaways that you can take action on is really key.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that's my teacher from the classroom coming through, even though one is a keynote and one's a workshop. We're working in both of them, okay? You're going to be writing. We're going to take some stop and jots. We're going to think about it, apply it, talk about it in the session. That's one thing I'm very grateful that we've always gotten great feedback on, is the engagement of these sessions. This is not a lecture. We are engaging in life. We learn by doing. So let's talk about it. Let's do it.
I agree. Oh, wonderful. Since, you know, you are an expert in finances, what are some of the misconceptions about finances, or what is that scarcity mindset that you've encountered in higher ed or corporate clients? Or
yeah, I'll say becoming a certified financial education instructor and becoming a financial therapist, you learn about these things, but when you actually engage with them, when you're actually in the field, when you're actually coaching individuals, I feel like that's when it becomes real. So I always want to say shout out to my clients, shout out to my coaching clients, shout out to my students, because from having the honor to work with them, I learn more about these things. And I hope that I can share some of these generalized aspects with your audience and make them see where it shows up in their lives. So a phrase that I've heard quite a bit is, if I make more, I'll feel more, insert positive word here, whether it's feel more secure, feel more happy, things of that nature. And this is inadvertently, or more so under the surface, this is us worshiping money, tying our worth or our happiness to money. And I've noticed that when these phrases come apparent, when these phrases of tying the amount of money we make to the amount of happiness we'll have or the amount of positive emotion we'll have, we just need to take a moment and have more introspection and really ask ourselves, why is that? I think why is one of the most powerful words. So for any of these phrases, I encourage anyone that relates to them, just ask yourself why. It might bring up some childhood things. Bring yourself a box of tissues, bring yourself a journal, but really ask yourself why. So if you're someone that you think that the more you make, the more happy you'll feel. Yes, money can provide ways to pay for things, but when it comes to true happiness, true joy, that comes from the inner. So let's talk about that, or let's write about that, right? Another phrase, or more so perspective, that I've heard is that it's not appropriate to talk about money. Growing up, there was this phrase like, you don't talk about race, religion, or politics at the table. And I would put an asterisk and say money. And oftentimes this can not only be a symptom of households that may be in low socioeconomic status or in poverty, but also households that have a high socioeconomic status. If one person was making all of the money, then you didn't need to talk about money. And sometimes it was also shunned if you talked about money. So I see this actually happen not only on one side of the spectrum, but also on the other side of the spectrum, this avoiding talking about money, having either silence, shame, or both about talking about money. And in those situations, I encourage not only say to journal about it, like I mentioned with this first one, but also finding those trusted group of friends. If you're a woman and you experience the struggles of the patriarchy and that's what causes you to not talk about finance, find another girlfriends. Let's talk about it. And of course, we have a lot of folks on social media, finfluencers, things of that nature talking about it, but don't forsake the importance of personal intimacy and having conversations in real life, even though, say, you might be able to talk about these things online. So I always want to just emphasize that communication is a way for us to overcome survival, to overcome isolation. So communicate with your community and steward that community around those discussions. And even in the For Our Last Names app, we're having some spaces for community for that. I could go on and on about the many different things I've heard, but the last thing I'll say is around hustle culture, that I have to, how would I describe it? That I can't spend anything until I've earned the right to relax, or you have to earn rest. This is hyper-control covered. You deserve rest. For anyone that feels that way, for anyone whose shoulders got up to their ears and hearing that, you deserve rest. And you don't, of course, there are multiple ways to engage in rest. There are ways that you can say, for example, go to the spa, go to the salon, these traditional things that we might have tied to money. But there are also, I would say, ancient, historical, and different contexts, other traditions that encourage you to find rest in going to the garden, going to the park free, sitting in grass free, just sitting in silence. Even the spiritual discipline of silence in itself, that can be rest. So sometimes we have to unwork our socialization and where we think, everything that is associated with rest, I have to pay for. That's actually not the case. Sometimes we just need to expand our mind around what can bring us joy, what can bring us rest. And especially in the digital age, there are so many ways to be exposed to different methods or even ancient methods of rest.
Excellent. Excellent. Such key phrases that I think many of us have heard or embraced or thought this is how it is. So thank you for sharing that. We are in a technology renaissance right now.
True.
It is. Woo. What are your thoughts about tech and innovation and finances currently?
I say that technology is our friend. I think that technology is our friend, and I think that we can't be afraid of it. If we are afraid of it, then that means we will not learn about it. And if we don't learn about it, then we put ourselves in vulnerable positions to be left behind. And I'll say as well, most cities have public libraries that are willing to host classes and are hosting classes on these things. There are nonprofit organizations that are teaching free AI certificates, Coursera, Google, these different resources that are available to us. So I will say, due to the access that has been provided by the World Wide Web and due to the extremely exponentially fast digital transition we're seeing with AI, leverage the resources around us, leverage the free resources around us. I use free with air quotes because we know our taxpayer dollars fund the library, but use resources around us to increase your competitive edge. Everyone is inherently made with value, and we also have opportunities to increase your value. So choose faith, not fear, lean in, do the work. And there's this universal law about the law of cause and effect. And so I do believe that if we do embrace this digital change, we can cause or we can create effects that are positive for us. We don't have to be left behind by this digital transformation. We can be involved in the causes that breed these effects.
So agree. Many opportunities. Oh, so you are currently pursuing graduate level work in economic justice. So what drew you to that area of economic justice?
Oh, man. After I completed my Bachelor of Science in Public Health from The Ohio State University, I always got to add that in. I found it very important to get practical experience in the field, which brought me to teaching and being in education for about 7 years. But I was called back to this graduate level work because I wanted to research. I wanted to answer the question, what is the impact of financial trauma on our economic engagement, whether it be our personal financial economic engagement, whether it be our community and nonprofit-based economic engagement, or even whether it be this institutional level economic engagement, taxes, I could go on and on around it. So in short, the short answer is I came back to this work because I wanted to uncover something that hadn't been discussed. I wanted to uncover something that no one had academically yet researched, specifically in this realm and bringing these worlds of education and mindset and psychology, economics, or even as I would say it in some settings, fintech, edtech, and mindset. How do we bring these things together? So my journey to studying social justice and specifically economic justice through an interfaith lens has come from a desire to push forward not only research, but also innovation, not just to create something that sits on a shelf, whether it be digital or physical, but to create solutions, innovative solutions that help people of all backgrounds, all faiths, all first generation experiences understand how to engage in economic liberation with self and with systems.
I love what you're saying about first, your work is very interdisciplinary. And to answer the big questions, we need to be interdisciplinary. We can't just rely on one discipline. And so your approach is fabulous in my book. And as a lifelong academic, over 35 years in academia and various roles throughout my career, I really appreciate the applied part that you mentioned, that you don't want it just to sit on a shelf to be in an academic journal. That is important. But it's also important to make sure that we translate our research out so that it's applicable to many people. And I feel you get that, and that is good. And so keep that. Do not let anyone beat it out of you through your journey.
Oh, thank you. And said, coming from the field, I feel like I'll speak to this transparently. The biggest learning curve for me in coming back to graduate school or entering academia has been the language. I'm used to being at grassroots. I'm used to keeping it real and using that VE that's neat. I keep it real. So I do want for anyone that is listening to know that if you have a calling in your heart, if you have a desire to engage in research, to create innovative solutions, don't allow those gaps, don't allow those learning curves to keep you from pursuing the work, because ultimately, at the end of the day, the best research leads to innovation. So if you come from the background of innovation, that is valuable. That is capital. Value that as you come into these spaces and hold it close to your heart and with value.
What advice would you give to first generation students that are navigating academic spaces as grad students? And this is something that's really close to my heart because I've helped mentor, support, and sometimes the academic spaces are a little hard to navigate for anyone. And first generation students sometimes, I don't want to say taken, or maybe they're taken advantage of in some ways. I'll just say that. And not supported as I feel like they should be. What advice would you give?
To not be afraid to ask. And especially for my eldest children or my eldest daughters or only children, like you might feel like, I don't want to ask for help. What do you mean? And especially in the age of AI, you might feel like I really don't need to ask anyone, but find a mentor, ask for help, find a community group, ask for help, find a sponsor, ask for help. It's important to ask for help. And there are many ways to do it, whether it be books, whether it be groups on your campus, groups outside of your campus. I really even would like to emphasize groups outside of your campus that are more in relation to, say, your hobbies or other interests outside of school, because sometimes if your entire academic career only revolves around that schooling experience, that education experience, you might lose yourself. So find mentors, not only academically, but also find life mentors. If you're looking to be in business, find business mentors. There's a good saying that says every good coach has a coach. I am a financial therapist. I am a financial coach, and I have my coach. There aren't many financial therapists out there, so I can't say that portion yet, but I have my own therapist and I have my own coach. So I encourage you, especially while being in school, people want to help students. So lean into that altruism that is still left in our society and ask for help.
Such good advice, because it is important. And it's scary sometimes to ask for help or to admit that you need help and that you don't know. But asking for help is so important.
Absolutely.
For anyone.
And that'll tell you if you have a good community or a good friendship. If you can't ask for help, that might be a sign that it's not the safest space for you. And even as someone that has went through a different journeys, academically different institutions, listen to yourself in this journey, especially if you are a first generation college student, first generation graduate student. Ask for help and also trust your intuition. If something feels off, trust your gut, lean into that, inquire about that. And it might be that institution isn't the right fit, but you still might be called to that research topic, to that innovative topic. Know that you have choices and cultivate opportunities to lean into those choices and to listen to your spirit.
So glad you said that, because I have found that oftentimes underrepresented graduate students don't realize that they do have choices. They don't have to stay at that institution. They don't have to keep that committee. They don't have to keep that advisor. They don't have to keep that advisor. Want or desire to make, then they need to find someone outside that can help walk them through that. But I have helped students navigate changing their whole doctoral committee. Because the individuals ended up not being the right ones to support the students to get to their goals. And so it's just, yeah, and like I said, a program or a university may not be the right place for them. The topic that they want to study, right. That might be the exact right topic. It just may not be the right space to do that in. So,
absolutely. And of course, if you're listening to this before you've applied to a program, ask the questions, set up the meetings, or ask if, you know, you can conduct this research and who are the right people to talk to that will be walking alongside you. But if you're already in that program, not all is lost. Not all is lost. There is still hope as well.
No, there absolutely is hope. There's people that will jump in and help you anywhere along the process, even at the end. If you're writing that dissertation and you're having some challenges, people will jump in and help. So you are just such a busy woman. How do you manage work, workshops, books, consulting, tech platforms, developing apps, graduate school? And then staying grounded in your purpose, because you're very purpose-driven, and I so appreciate that. How do you manage all of it?
Thank you for naming and noticing that. And listeners might hear or see I'm a little sniffly today from all of the travel and coming off of a great week of volunteering with our youth and having their summer camp and just see lives change. So I will say I'm not superwoman. I still get sick sometimes. I still wake up with eye crusts. Okay, all the like normal things. still engaging in that. But one of the things that helps me from the inside out, because I do believe that our energies and what happens in our life come from the inside out, is maintaining spiritual disciplines, stewarding my body. What, no matter where you are in the spectrum, whether you're like super into the spiritual or whether you're super into the physical, we only got one body. We've only got one body. So whether it's meditation that makes you feel spiritually well or prepares you for a good workout, whether it be silence and just being able to sit with your own thoughts of all the long professional to-do lists going on in the day, or even silence that helps you process the scriptures that you might be reading, or whether it's even a pilgrimage and say you're going to a different country or a religious space that is meaningful for you in your own religious tradition, or a pilgrimage for the sake of exploring the trails and the nature around you. I believe that all of these spiritual disciplines have both spiritual internal benefits as well as physical external benefits, no matter what your belief system is. So for me, I've really enjoyed practicing silence, even deciding to drive some trips instead of fly some trips, because I'd rather take that time to be silent and reflect than be in a busy airport, and really curating my life around these disciplines that I must keep number one in order to feel the way that I need to feel, to have the energy I need to have to do all that I'm called to. I am my best asset. I can invest in the markets, but I have to invest in me first.
I love that.
So what has been your biggest learning moment as a founder and CEO?
My biggest learning moment as a founder and CEO has been that there is power in the pivot. There's power in the pivot. When I was in the classroom and I loved what I was doing and my business was starting to grow and I was coaching clients during my plan periods and I was taking interviews during my lunch blocks, and I had to go through a period of grieving, and that I could see that my calling was now growing outside of the classroom. And that was a pivot I had to take. When we first pitched for our last names and I talked about how I paid off my student loans from investing, and that was due to over 500 hours of learning, and now definitely more than I feel like it's more than 5,000 hours now. The original idea for our last names was education unlocking investing access. And although that was good, it was not necessarily what was needed to create the long-term systemic change. So we pivoted, and it took a lot of work. It delayed the product. But now we see the fruit of that decision on the other end, and this 80% plus positive satisfaction rate, and the first generation students that are using this and working on this, seeing the value. It was a painful pivot, but it was a purposeful pivot. And even now in my academic journey and having this one intention and finding a different environment to live out this intention, I've had to pivot. And so for any entrepreneur, any innovator, any educator listening, there's power in the pivot. Make it a prayerful pivot, not a hasty pivot, but don't be afraid to pivot.
Thanks for saying that. Pivot was a word that came up a lot during the pandemic, a lot. And I think people were like, hey, if I have to hear the word pivot one more time. But it's something that we do. And it is something that innovators have to do. And it takes courage to do it. It sounds like you are very thoughtful in your pivot.
Aiming to be. And I'll always say, I look back on my life and I see this divine thread placed through. Even when I placed Tulsa is number 7 out of 10 on my preference list for Teach for America, I wish that I could say that at the time I knew I was ancestrally called here and my grandfather grew up in this area just 5 minutes away from where I live and own a home now, but I didn't know that then. However, I was prayerful about it. I took those spiritual disciplines and was intentional about it, right? So I will say that we don't always know what's on the other end of a pivot, but what I did know was I was called to education. And I went through the process, the interview process allowed it to take me where it did. There were times when I even wanted to leave Tulsa, but I took a moment and I noticed that every pivot intersection, because sometimes you don't take the pivot, right? At every pivot intersection, I saw the purpose connected to it, education, ancestral healing, epigenetic healing. This is the place in which to do it. So I think one of the powerful aspects of a pivot is not only say when you do take the pivot and move into a different city, different job, different things, but also when you see what roots you and choose you to say, actually, I'm going to stay here and I'm not going to pivot.
So it's listening. It's really listening to, if it's divine listening, it's the universe, whatever someone believes in, but it's that listening.
Yeah. Listen to what has already been revealed to you. Listen to what needs to be revealed. Listen to your purpose. Listen to your calling. And if it feels not aligned, let it fly.
That is good. That is good. You worked with a lot of different entities, businesses and universities. And how have you navigated as an entrepreneur working with academia and universities and then also companies and businesses? And are there any differences for you?
I'll say there haven't been many differences for me when I think about working with private higher education institutions, when I think about working with public state schools, when I think about working with seminaries, when I think about working with corporations. Having the right systems helps you work with them smoothly. Having integrity in your product or service helps you deliver the right way. So I would say it's really just about having systems and having integrity in your product. And that's what's been most successful for me and my business.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Absolutely. Some of our big goals, we want to impact 1,000 last names. The brand name is not just a tagline. It's true. We want to impact multiple last names, multiple families. And so our first major milestone is impacting 1,000 last names. And we want to work with both individuals and institutions to bring that change. We've already had some great individual users on the app, and they are enjoying their experience with our web app. But especially as we launch our app store version this fall, we really want to make sure that this gets in the hands of the right higher education institutions, the right workforce development institutions, the right corporations that want to invest in their best asset, which is their people, and that want to provide for our last names as a part of their workplace benefits, their student benefits, their employee benefits. And that's really how we look to create change and reach that first milestone of impacting 1,000 last names. That can easily be done with one institution stepping up to the plate and saying, yes, we want to create change for our last names. So that's really the big goal right now that we're focused on.
Best of luck with that. It's a great goal and contribution to society. So thank you for making that contribution to society.
Thank you.
What would you tell your younger self if you're just sitting thinking about, even though you're young, you are young already. So what would you tell your really young self?
What I would tell, let's bring it back to 5-year-old Raquel that said, I don't want to be a teacher. They don't make enough money. I would say to 5-year-old Raquel that where you impact, income will come. And although my time in the classroom, according to what my income was at the time, my salary at the time, technically it wasn't a lot of income. But leaning into that skill of teaching, leaning into that spiritual gift of teaching, allowed my income, be it fiscal capital, social capital, there are so many different types of capital, right? I would tell myself that where you impact, you will have income. And not only income in terms of dollars and cents, but income in terms of diversified capital. Like I said, that social, that fiscal, that communal capital, that health-based capital, right? Impacting, especially as a teacher, I would tell her, lean in.
I love it. I love it. 5-year-old Raquel has really grown into someone that is truly impacting society. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you. I shout out to my students, shout out to my parents, shout out to the people that have come before me that have set great examples. I walk in the footsteps of greatness.
Yes, we do. We really do. And our last question that we ask every guest is, how do you define innovation?
Yes, I define innovation as creativity. As a person of faith and as someone that studies ancient scripture, I love Genesis 1:1, which is, it talks about the first verb in the Bible, and it says, in the beginning, God created. And no matter what your beliefs are, most folks do have an understanding that there's something up there that created us. And so I think that's the best innovation of all. That's awesome that we are created beings, that the trees that I'm looking out the window at now are also created beings. And so I believe that we have that same power to create, whether it be creating a solution for people with different abilities, whether it be creating new policies, whether it be creating new ways to teach about the alphabet to little kids who are learning a language for the first time. I believe that innovation is creating. And for that reason, it's not just entrepreneurs who are creators and innovators. It's educators. It's corporate leaders. It's folks that are in even hourly jobs. Like, the ability to innovate is not limited to one's role. The ability to innovate is rooted in creating. So I love that word create, and I think that it's innately tied to being able to innovate.
What a fabulous definition. Thank you for that. And the enthusiasm that went along with the definition too. Raquel, thank you for being here and sharing your journey, your insights, your purpose, and the offerings that you are providing to help change people's lives. So thank you for sharing this time with us.
Thank you, Yolanda, for having me. It's been a great pleasure to even reflect on this journey we call life, and experiences from public health to the classroom to starting my first business to diving into financial technology and doing this journey as a first generation wealth builder, as a Black woman in American society. And I am just so grateful for your platform that talks about innovation and how we can be insightful about it. So thank you so much for what you were doing as well.
Oh, thank you. I will have you back. We'll make sure that our guests have ways to contact you within our show notes. So we'll put up your platforms, your LinkedIn, your website, and all of those things. And when the app launches, let's have another conversation, because we'd love to, share that out with the world too.
Thank you. Let's build wealth for our last names.
Absolutely. Oh, to our guests, thank you for being here for this conversation. Raquel reminds us that innovation is not just about technology. It's about creating systems and solutions that honor our stories, heal generational trauma, and build sustainable futures for our last names. So if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and comment on the podcast. It helps us to continue to bring you impactful conversations like this one. Make sure that you follow Raquel and her work and stay informed about her entrepreneurial innovations. Stay connected with us on social media platforms and visit our innovationandinsights.com website for resources, upcoming episodes, and ways to engage with the Innovation Insights community. For the time being, thank you for being here. Keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.